Congratulations on getting here. I had no idea if we were really going to have class or not, given the forecasts, but it wasn't, I mean, I haven't been out there in the last 30 minutes, but I assume that it wasn't terrible, right? Yeah. Okay. We'll keep our eyes peeled, but I think it's going to be fine for this time while we're here. No problem. We haven't really started yet. Just got my mic on. You have to be patient with me today. I've just led a training all day long. I am talked out. My tongue is hardly working. So even more reason for you all to talk. I'm going to appeal to your compassion. Ask you all to talk. Right. I have some ideas with that. But anyway, let's take a minute to decompress, let the day wash off of us, forget about the snow, the ice, what we're going to do tomorrow or not, what just happened. Just let it all slide off of your mind, off of your body. Check your meditation posture. Go over the 7 points in your mind. If you have them, I'll remind you later in the hour when we do another meditation. But just see if you can remind yourself of what they are and check your posture. And then put all of your awareness on your breath, the sensation of the air coming in and out of your nostrils or your abdomen rising and falling. And then one inhale, one exhale is one. That's one round. Then you would count two for the next inhale, exhale. So take a minute and put all of your awareness on your breathing. You can count to five and then back to one, or if you prefer 10, whatever helps your concentration. And as your mind slips away from that, gently, gently bring it back and just start again. Congratulate yourself for noticing that it slipped away from that, from the count. And see if you can maintain a state of alert, relaxed mind with the count. See if you can be aware of when the thought starts to rise, and instead of following that thought, just letting it go and melt, have that thought melt back into the ocean of your mind, then you'll notice a little lull, just like the lull between your breaths, and then the next thought will probably start to rise. If you can become aware of that energy of your thoughts, just like you're becoming aware of the energy of your breath, the point then is to expand that space between the thoughts rising and try to rest in that space. Now, with the same concentration that you have on your breath, put that concentration, that focus on reviewing what are the benefits of developing bodhicitta, or if it's easier to think about what are the benefits of cherishing others, and what are the downsides of just cherishing yourself. You can even use today as an example. What would today have looked like, or a part of today have looked like, if you had destroyed self-cherishing, or if you had developed bodhicitta? What would have been different? Or even if you had more patience? We're going to try a little experiment today, because we've been, we talked a little bit last time about the mic, and I'll repeat questions, or the mic sometimes gets in the way of people asking questions. So I have an idea. You can shoot it down. Don't shoot me, but you can shoot down the idea. I think part of the problem is that it's so hard, you don't have to wait for the mic to go all the way over there, and then come all the way over here, and then go back over there. So I had an idea about what if everybody who's sitting in chairs sat on one side, which could make it easier to pass the mic, and If you don't have to do that, but I'm just thinking, like, maybe that's part of the problem is getting the mic back and forth. We get everybody sit closer together. Also, I thought, well, you know, I don't know all the people who are watching either, but I know at least one person. Her name's Eileen. She's probably watching right now. You can turn and wave. Hi, Eileen. So she would very much like to hear what you all are saying, and she's watching every Monday, and I think there's other people who are as well. Other people watching, you can certainly email me at the Kadampa Center. I'll get the email if you have a question or you want us to know your name. That way makes it a little bit easier to know why we're using this mic all the time, and you know we'll have a little more patience with the mic as well, and we are looking into some other options. But what do you think about that? Any ideas about that? Use the mic. No, I'm just kidding. But like, you know, just after that meditation, I wanted to see what you all thought and some questions about that. And in the old space, you know, when we're all like really it was from where the altar is to maybe where you're sitting, it was easy. You know, it was very easy to just start chatting. Everybody heard each other. Even one mic holding here, everybody would get it. So I forgot my train of thought here. That's what I'm saying. I'm really tired. But anyway, so that's a thought I had about a way to make this a little bit easier and more inclusive for the people at home. For a long time, I just kept forgetting that people were actually watching this. You know, I was just like, I just had to wear this thing, which I hated. And then I would get some emails that, oh, wow, people really are watching. So we can include them in the conversation, and I'll ask them to write us if they've got questions or thoughts or comments. So where is the mic? Okay, great. We got the mic man. The mic man. So anything about that meditation that we just did that you have thoughts or comments or questions about it? Okay, so we're going to move on then to some of the articles because I do have a responsibility to cover those and answer any questions that come up from those. So last week we didn't talk about the one that had been on the assignment, which was covering the six perfections. And does anybody remember the relationship between the six perfections and bodhicitta? So these are the activities that bodhisattvas are engaged in when they are moving from aspirational bodhicitta to engaged bodhicitta. So aspirational bodhicitta has already arisen, but it's not fully engaged in activity. It's already that wish, you know, that wish to be actively engaged in bodhisattva deeds. Engaged bodhicitta is the six perfections. And the top list, giving, morality, patience, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom are the six perfections. They're sometimes called different things, and there's lots involved with them. So, you know, it's easier if you read the article so that I don't have to repeat it all, and then you can ask me questions about it. But there's categories within categories within categories in Buddhism. It's one of the great things. It's like a little accordion file. It can all be wrapped up, and you can take it with you. And then during a meditation, you can spread it all out, and you can go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into it. So what you may have seen in that article is, you know, there's different types of, for example, giving. And these are also, if you're studying the Lam Rim or you're coming to the Wednesday night class with Geshe-la on the Lam Rim, these are also all things that are included in the Lam Rim. Everything we talk about here is included in the Lam Rim, which is this huge accordion file, right? So the four types of giving, you're giving property, and that's the thing that we're most familiar with giving. It doesn't mean land, but it means material things. You know, you give somebody lunch, you give them some sleep on your couch, whatever you're giving them, physical things. Dharma. And that can be defined in lots of different ways. It can be, you know, explaining something to somebody, answering their question. But it can also be helping them to understand their own ways of taming their mind. Because Dharma isn't just Buddha Dharma. But, you know, if you remember the definition of Dharma, it's really that which stops suffering. So it is its own broad category in itself. What's helping somebody, what was helping somebody's mind, you know, towards that goal of ending suffering. Giving someone refuge. And again, that may be, I think in the article they talk about, you know, if you're rescuing an animal, then that's giving someone refuge. Somebody's coming to you for shelter, for help, that's giving them refuge. I know Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who some of you have met or will meet, there was some stray dog that had come out to his, wherever he was staying, and so he was taking care of it, and he was saying, this dog has taken refuge in me. So it's not just that typical, sometimes we just think of it as taking formal refuge vows, but it's in all kinds of ways, which is why I liked what Thich Nhat Hanh had said about, you know, you must become the happiest person on the planet, otherwise people can't take refuge in you. The happier you become, the more people will be taking refuge in your happiness. And then active love. And then we get to morality. And lots of different things to say about morality. But, you know, when you take a vow, any kind of vow, I think even the Buddhist, the Tibetan definition of vow is something that protects your mind. So even you know, marriage vows are meant to protect that relationship. They're not the law, you know. They're meant, you know, follow these things, and they're meant to help that couple maintain their love. That's what it's all about. And that's why, you know, as we have kind of evolved, people write their own vows. So there's kind of this template for what the vows are, and then individual couples add some more onto that, knowing what will help them protect their own relationship. So in what are we protecting with vows, or when we think of morality? In the article, they talk about the three gates. Remember, the three gates are your body, speech, and mind. These are the ways that we create karma. These are the ways that we create trouble. These are the ways that we create virtue, is with our body, our speech, and our mind. And certainly, you know, like in AA, they say, you know, bring your body and your mind will follow, and also bring your mind and everything else will follow. So those are the three gates. And when we think about morality or vows or promises or anything, it's like looking at those three gates as though they're, you know, kind of mischievous children, and we need to make sure that they don't get into too much trouble. There's this one wonderful quote that I think His Holiness, I read it from His Holiness, and he's probably quoting somebody else, that, you know, if you have an injured limb, you've hurt your arm, and you're moving across the room, you're very careful. I had once a really bad, really terrible bruise on my shin when I lived in New York City. Oh, my goodness. Every time I got on the subway, I was just like this with my shin because everybody's briefcases, and it was just like, it was like a magnet for my shin. So I just sat there on the train like this the whole time. And what His Holiness was saying is, if we only realize that's exactly what our mind is like. It's like one big aching bruise, and that what we should be doing constantly is being as careful with our mind as I was with my shin. Because the littlest thing that bumps into my mind and I'm, you know, I'm hurting, and then I'm hurting others. Make sense? You know, that we're so sensitive. I think Robert Thurman has changed sentient beings when he talks and calls us sensitive beings. Because we're all so sensitive, you know, and we can't just erase that. We are sensitive beings. So how do we figure out how to protect that so that we're not easily hurt and then lashing out or doing whatever we do when we're easily hurt? Everybody has a different story around that. And then the other thing that morality, there's three aspects to morality. One is protecting the three gates. The other one is protecting others, protecting others in the same way that we would protect ourselves. And that's tricky, you know, because what do you mean by that? And is it really our job? And sometimes we get into a lot of trouble when we think, I'm doing this for your own good, you know, and I'm going to tell you whatever. I mean, it's just tricky, which is why the third aspect is very critical to that second one. And that is that we have skillful means in the ways that we operate. So oftentimes our intention may be very good about asking somebody to do something or other, but our method for doing it is very unskillful. So I heard this story about one time. Does everybody know who Lama Zopa Rinpoche is? Okay, his photo's up here somewhere. And he's the spiritual director for the FPMT. And I heard this story. He's notorious for his incredible patience and how much he will stretch yours. And, you know, and he has such incredible devotion and it's just see, it's like he sees things all the time in that way. It's not, I have to conjure it up and work on. He's just like there, it seems to me, all the time for him. So, I heard this story about how he was about to give a teaching, and so he had the nuns who were there set up this altar, and it took them hours because it was really intricate, and all these offerings and all these things around it. And then they opened the doors for people to come in, and this relative newcomer had come in, and he sat in a way where he was, I don't know, in a chair or on the floor with his feet completely facing the altar, which is considered very rude and disrespectful. But the nuns went up to Rinpoche and they said, what should we do? Should we go and tell him to move? Because that's just, it's not good for anybody that he's sitting like that. And Rinpoche said, no, that would be very unskillful because it would make him think, what in the world? You know, why are you doing this? And it would turn him off. So instead, he said, no, move the altar. So they had to dismantle everything and reset it up. But what Rinpoche saw is that's hugely beneficial for them to do this. And they'll have to work on their nuns, and they're in this practice. They're going to have to work on their mind not to lose their patience with this, and they're spending all this time setting up another altar. How wonderful. Which reminds me, I did want to say something about the altar and all in this room in general. You know, it's like somebody was asking me some question about the altar, and I was thinking how... It's not really that unusual. Like, you know, you go on a vacation, you had a really nice trip. Don't you bring back photos and put them on your desk or in your house or something? Because you want to remember that state of mind that you had in that and that vacation, you know, and you tell people about it. And, you know, I hear people at work saying, God, I want to keep that feeling I had on my trip to the Rocky Mountains or wherever it was. And that's why we put all those little reminders around us in a place where we're not always mindful of that state of mind. And it's kind of like all these tankas and all these statues are like postcards saying, wish you were here, you know. Yeah. We're having a great time. Wish you were here. And then that's why they're all here, to kind of remind us and, you know, get our mind going in that way. Because when we leave it, at least for me, like 99% of everything else I'm seeing is not like that. Although, you know, we can put on those glasses to try to see it that way. That's one of, somewhere in all of this, there's that as well. Okay, so let's move on to patience. There's three types. When we are harmed by others. When we are suffering, and the patience of keeping our concentration. And the patience when we are suffering, I wrote this little note next to it, because it doesn't mean that we excuse me. It doesn't mean that we would stop working to end our suffering. It means, though, that we have patience while we're in that situation. So, you know, take Tibet as a perfect example. The Tibetans are still working for their country. They still would like to have their own country. Doesn't mean they just stop and give all that up. But it means that in the meantime, they try not to act out of, you know, revenge and try to maintain their culture and try to still keep their patience. So I think that's an important thing to remember. And as we talked about last time, everything is about... we can use everything. We can use our illness as a way of trying to increase our bodhicitta. We can use our happiness as a way of offering. So, you know, if we really have renunciation, until then we can just practice this. Any little wonderful thing that happens to us, we're immediately, like, mentally offering it. I think it's the thing that I like the most and I can forget the easiest is mentally offering. It's kind of like, you know, that's not going anywhere. I remember I struggled with this. You guys wouldn't believe how much I struggled with all of this stuff in the beginning. It was like mental offering. What in the world, you know? Doesn't mean it seems to make any sense to me. And I present these questions to myself, and I wrestle with them for like weeks or months. And then when I have an answer, then it's like, the problem never comes back. So I was really wrestling with this whole idea of mental offering. And then two things came to me. One was, it seemed like it was an antidote to just this consumer mind that I have of like, oh, this is nice, this is nice. It was an antidote to that. And then the next thing that happened is I was in the car one day and it was this really long line of us and somebody was trying to get out of a parking lot and I let them go. Maybe it was the other way around. Yeah, it was the other way around. I was trying to get in this long line of cars and somebody let me in and I said, thank you. And I realized they can't hear me. Maybe sometimes you can see me wave, right? They can't hear me. That doesn't matter. That doesn't stop me from instantly saying thank you, because I do appreciate that. If I don't say thank you, I don't really think about should I say thank you or not. It becomes a habit. And that's the same thing as mental offering. It becomes a habit if you practice it. So just like saying thank you, that was, you know, brought into my life when I was a kid, it's important to say, and it also changes my thoughts and my feeling when I say thank you. If I said screw you when I'm in front of them, then I'm just reinforcing that, like I should be there first, you know, me. Instead I'm like, really, I'm being grateful, and I know that it's contagious. So I don't know how I got off onto that.
Part two, patience.
Lord knows. Okay, yeah, mental offering. That there's always something we can use. And so the minute we feel something wonderful happen to us, you know, send it up and offer it and wish that everybody could have that. It's not diminishing what you have. It's not like, ooh, I feel bad that I've got this good luck. It's more like just open arms generosity. When the monks who were staying at my house and I'd first take them to like the mall and the Harris Teeter, I think I've told you all this, they were just amazed because for them it was like they could just do all this mental offering. So you see during the pujas they gather all this food together to be these masses of food so you can make more offerings. They'd never been in a country where all that food was all the time, all these places. I took them to K&W cafeteria and then they would bring their friends like, look, just to be able to see all that food together and then mentally offer it. And so it's also, if you believe then in the three gates planting seeds, that mental offering does plant huge seeds of merit in your mind stream, even though it's not yours. There's all kinds of different offerings. You offer what you have and you offer the things you don't have. You offer things that you can touch and put on the altar. You offer things that you will never touch. And then you also, you know, sometimes there's a limit to what you can do, but you can always wish that you can do more. So when Geshe-la and I go and feed ducks, first of all, he's saying a lot of mantras when he's feeding them. But then he's also thinking that the next time that we meet in another lifetime, when these ducks may not be ducks, they may be beings, may I be able to teach them this mantra. This lifetime, I'm giving them food and I'm saying this mantra and I'm wishing them a better rebirth. Next lifetime, may I be in the position to teach them this mantra, because then if they learn that mantra, they'll be able to create more merit, and on it goes. You're always looking at kind of this, the long haul, not just this minute. Okay. Joyous effort. Oh, and then, wait a minute. When we are harmed by others, with patience. Any questions about that? And remember, we're talking like on a huge scale too. So there's our kind of practice of this, and then when the Bodhisattva practices this, one way I've heard about that too is the patience to continue your practice when you're being harmed or impeded by others. So Geshe-la wanted to go see, this is a long time ago and he still lived in my house, he wanted to see that movie, I think it's called The Passion of Christ, with Mel Gibson wrote it, produced it or whatever. And so we went to see it, and during that really awful bloody scene, you know, Geshe-la turned to me and he said, perfection of patience. He goes, that's what Jesus was practicing there, because, you know, he's not getting angry and these people are hugely harming him and he's still keeping his practice. And so that, he said, that's a huge example right there of the perfection of patience. Like, I got it. I was like, oh, okay, this is huge. You know, not just, I'm thinking of like not losing my temper when somebody pulls in front of me. You know? So that's my practice. And then I'm like, oh, there's the perfection of it. Got it. Got it. And I had also told him, His first Christmas year, he was asking me all kinds of questions about Christmas and Santa Claus. And so I told him about St. Nicholas. And I had just been reading about the real St. Nicholas and some of the things that the real St. Nicholas had done, which we still see in this kind of like trickle-down form of Santa Claus and the red and white, you know, and giving these gifts. And anyway, I told him this whole story, and he said, oh, okay. So he probably mastered the perfection of giving. And that's why when a saint or a bodhisattva has mastered one of those perfections, it's still here somewhere around. You can still see its effects, which I think is so cool. You know, it's powerful stuff. Okay, so joyous effort is sometimes, what's it called in this article? It's not called joyous effort. Energy? Just energy? Perfection of energy, okay. Sometimes it's called joyous perseverance. All right, let's talk about the three kinds first. One is the effort that stops desire for unprofitable things and turns it into Dharma things or Dharmic things. It doesn't mean that, you know, again, it doesn't mean that you have to, like, stop going to the movies. You know, but you're working with your attachment to whatever it is, but you're also then turning it into something that's more productive. So sometimes it means getting away from the object that you're attached to, but sometimes it means just transforming it so that it is does become productive. Does that make sense? The joyous effort that prevents against fatigue. So this is how to, you know, continue to do something, especially some dharmic activity, with joyous effort, not just with like, oh, okay, I made this promise, here I got to do this again today. You know, I mean, again, we're talking about the perfection of it. We're wrestling with all those thoughts. The perfection is you have that joyous effort, and so it you don't have that kind of fatigue. You're doing something joyously. You know, like just if I really, really got and understood on a profound level the noble truth of suffering, then I would spend all night here just putting offerings on the altar, because I found the doctor who's going to cure this incurable illness that I've got, and making offerings would be like just a piece of cake. You know, it'd be just like complete pleasure, and I would not have fatigue around doing anything that was virtuous. And the third one is the joyous effort that produces confidence. It overcomes doubt. They make an analogy of it's this kind of effort is like the wind fanning the flame. So you've got something burning on the hillside, and then when the wind comes along, the whole hillside goes up in flames. Joyous effort is that condition, that extra little tipping point for our practice. And the next one is concentration. You know, it's very practical. We talk about it all the time in terms of our own meditation, our focus meditation. But on the highest level, when perfected, then the mind can turn to anything that you're putting it on. It's able to see the highest truth about the mind's real nature. And I don't think we have that tanka in here about single-pointed concentration. I think it's outside in the lobby, yeah. So you know, there's lots of teachings you can get on how to really develop that kind of concentration where it's critical for being able to see emptiness and develop wisdom, which is the last perfection. So all other meditations then prepare our mind for the final object of meditating on emptiness. And that when we are able to really realize emptiness perfectly, it removes all ignorance. And in this article, you'll see that last paragraph, there's a little bit of a mistake on that paragraph. It's probably in the translation. I got Geshe-la to look at it with me. I didn't bring it with me, that article with me. But sure. Thank you. Yeah. So let me just read this. Once we come close to a thorough understanding of emptiness, we're on the way to the perfection of wisdom, the complete comprehension of emptiness. The path of seeing when emptiness is experienced directly is a transformation of the living being's mind. We are no longer sentient beings, but arhats or arya beings. It should be we're no longer ordinary beings, because you're a sentient being until you have complete enlightenment, okay? And then, And then it says you're arhat or arya beings. Thank you. So there's these five paths. I'm just going to introduce this to you now. It's too much to kind of go into all of this at once. But I want to introduce some of these concepts. We can get a whole lot more information about them. You might have heard of these five paths: the path of accumulation, the path of preparation, and at that point, those first two paths, the path of accumulation and preparation, you're a bodhisattva on all of this, but you're still considered what we're saying is an ordinary being. You haven't seen emptiness yet. The path of seeing is where he talks about that totally transforms us into either an arhat or an arya. And then there's kind of these two different paths from there. Some people skip over. It gets really, really complicated. Talk about that accordion. But at that point, you're either an arya or an arhat being. Okay? Then the next path is intense concentration, and then the path of no more training. Done. I just want to introduce those terms to you. So it's things that I have to go over and over and ask Eshelo again and again, because I get it and then I don't use it very much, and then here I am again. I was like, oh, what are this? And so I had called him about that article because I thought there was something a little amiss in that translation. Okay. The most important thing I want you to take out of this, though, are the five perfections. Yeah, six perfections. And when you reach the path of seeing, you're no longer developing new karma, but there's still some old karma, some still old defilements that you're dealing with. And these layers can now be eradicated because you're seeing, you have greater wisdom. So until we reach that level, you know, we're creating new karma all the time that we're also then going to be working with and purifying and blah, blah, blah. When you reach that level, the path of seeing. So that's why you might hear sometimes people say there's a difference between nirvana and complete enlightenment, or somebody has, they're a bodhisattva, but they're not a Buddha, you know, and we sometimes get confused with all these different levels. You can, that's because it's one step at a time. So you get to this place where you're no longer creating new karma, but you still have some old layers to eradicate and to get through. And now it's going to be a whole lot easier because you're not developing new stuff to deal with. Okay? Also, remember we talked about the two types of conventional bodhicitta, aspiring and active, or aspiring and engaged. Once you're an engaged bodhicitta, you are accruing positive virtue, positive forces, positive energy without interruption. Just like before when I said, I'm on my way to New Orleans and then I'm in New Orleans. When I'm in New Orleans, I'm always in New Orleans until I leave. Same thing with engaged bodhicitta. You're always then, all of your activities, breathing, sleeping, every single thing of it is just accumulating more positive virtue. Right now we're practicing with it, yeah.
So you're accumulating more positive energy, but you're not accumulating more karma. I guess I'm confused.
Oh, I see.
Those two.
Well, yeah, let me double check on that with Geshe-la. Engaged is anytime that you're on the path of a bodhisattva. You're already in doing these six perfections. Now you're an engaged bodhicitta, okay? When you reach the path of seeing, it's less clear because you're working with all of these six perfections. You still might be on the first path of accumulation or path of preparation, but when you reach the path of seeing, now you have stopped creating new karma. But I'll double check with him to make sure it would seem to me to make sense that what you're doing is you're no longer creating negative karma. And the actions that you have are purifying the past karma. Okay, so you're still accumulating something to move you forward, but you are no longer accumulating negative karma. And I'll double check on that just because I want to be crystal clear, but that's a good point. You have to be doing something. You have to be creating causes and conditions for that tipping point, for that other tipping point. And one of the things I've always loved when Geshe-la talks about is that once you achieve bodhicitta, then all other beings around you are completely safe because you're not going to be harming them in any way. Right now we're harming people even when we don't want to be harming people. You know, we're just... But once we have that kind of heart and mind, everyone else is entirely safe around us. I wrote all these notes. I hardly even remember doing this, but you know, this weekend I was really thinking about it, I guess. And that the selfish... Yeah. It's really like when our selfish mind changes into, you know, a good heart. And, you know, just how phenomenally difficult that is. It doesn't mean we're changing others, because oftentimes we can see so clearly, oh, you know, this person's like really focused on what's important to them. And how do we then skillfully work with that so that we're getting out of the way of it, but we're also getting out of the way of our own mind? I think that's one of the trickier things. So, you know, if our goal, I guess this is one of the things we really need to meditate and figure out is the thing that brings us the most happiness helping others. So I remember hearing Rinpoche say that, you know, making the goal of your life being helpful to somebody else. It could be a couple other people. I mean, and then you're trying to expand that to be more and more people. But if your goal in life is to be helpful, then even if your business fails, even if you're in prison, you can still reach that goal. But it's really hard to get our mind kind of focused that is our goal, because it is, because this is where we live. But it really hit me like, yeah, if that was my goal, then all these other things could happen and I could still reach that goal. And I could still be happy because that I'm reaching that goal. Okay, I'm really tired of talking. Anybody want to ask a question?
Steve.
Yeah.
I think it was the third of the five paths, seeing. Is that where you don't accumulate karma anymore? Is that?
That's where you become either an Arya or an Arhat being.
Okay. That wouldn't be like in the human realm. This might not be within this class, but you're not in the human realm anymore. Are you like a god or something above human?
You're still a sentient being, but you're no longer an ordinary being.
Right. That's what I mean.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, and then one other thing. Patience, what really helped me understand that was thinking it's patience with your own mind, not letting your mind get to you. You control your mind. You know, you're not patient with somebody who pulls out in front of you, but you're patient with the way you react to things and don't let yourself...
Exactly. That's a good point.
Yeah.
You know, I think most of you know I teach mediation. I manage a program for the state. And I was looking at this video, and this woman was saying pretty much what you're saying, Chris, was she was saying when you're engaged in kind of a dispute with somebody, try to notice the minute that you decide to fight. And I thought it's the same kind of thing, like try to notice in your mind the minute you decide not to be patient anymore. The minute you decide, I mean, sometimes it happens so fast for us, we can't catch it, but that's what this is all about, is slowing it down. Remember when I was talking about I couldn't wait to lose my patience because I needed to start with something small so I could see it, so I could stop it. That's the same thing as like, whatever you know is your biggest problem, You know, try to figure out so you can watch when you are on that cusp. When are you making that decision? Because then you'll have more ability and more choices. And I think, I mean, that's a lot of what I'm hearing you say too, Chris. It's, you know, it's your mind. Yeah, these people are doing all these other things, and they'll always be doing all these other things. And so it's your own patience and that we're expanding. Yeah. When you reach that level of arhat or arya, that's when you're called a foe destroyer. And you've destroyed your own foes.
F-O-E.
F-O-E. Foe destroyer, sometimes you hear that term, or conqueror.
You get like a cape.
You do.
Superhero.
You do. You get a cape.
Really cool.
Pick your colors now. And that's when you've stopped cyclic existence. So, yeah, something to look forward to.
Question?
Yes, please.
You were talking about mentally offering, and mm-hmm. that reminded me of a question I had about Tong Lin related. How can you give me some phrases to think of to offer your pain or suffering in Tong Lin so
some
that
phrases.
Others do not suffer? For instance, if you have a headache.
Uh-huh.
What did you say? Something like, I have...
Right. May everybody else's headache dissolve into mine so that nobody else has to have this headache anymore. Mm-hmm. Say you've got the flu, you know, and you can start by thinking, I mean, it feels pretty miserable, so you can just think, you know, how many other people in Raleigh right now or North Carolina have this flu? How many people this winter have died of the flu? You know, how many people are... So you're just trying to expand it so it's not just your flu, first of all. How many other people are suffering with this same thing? I'm pretty lucky compared to them because whatever. You can find out whatever you have that's a little bit better. And then, again, if this helps, just check it out and see if it helps. May everybody else's flu come into my flu. You know, may I hold all everybody else's mm-hmm. illness now. So that they don't have to have it, and I'll finish all of their illnesses by getting better or by going through this. I'm going to go through this so that they don't have to go through it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And see if it helps. I mean, sometimes it might not help, but practice. Again, practice is something easier, and then see if it helps. It might... You know, what it's meant to do is, again, we're talking about mind training with everything, so it's meant to... make your mind more patient with your suffering and make you have some joyous effort with that suffering. So like, okay, I don't mind this because, I mean, we all know examples of somebody who, you know, you're in a situation and you will take that on for somebody else. You know, you will carry somebody's bag across the street because it's hard for them, right? You don't mind doing that. And so it's the same kind of thing, but now it's, you know, you're amping it up and up and up. And it seems to make it easier for you to bear that burden if it's more than just me. You know, it's more than just me with this cut finger or whatever I've got, right? It's more than just me. I'm actually going to be helping all these other people by going through this. I mean, I can't imagine anybody going through childbirth just for the fun of it, right? So it's because you're doing this for this other being. And, you know, I think it's, like, remarkable that women go through childbirth and don't turn on that little creature that just came out of them. That, you know, I've heard of the father sometimes saying, I couldn't take it anymore. I just wanted to yank that kid out because it was causing my wife so much suffering. But the wife was not feeling that way. She was like, don't hurt the baby, you know, don't, you know, whatever. So I don't know if that helps, you know, but it's because it's for somebody else. It's not just about us. There was some other example I had with that childbirth thing. Oh, so I watched this movie. I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it's K4 or K. What's one of those mountains? It's got a K in it. K2, K9, K2. So I was watching this and, you know, they weren't very well prepared, and they had some Sherpas who ended up having to do a lot of work. But so when they were getting close to the summit, they were psyched, right? And they were already late the sun, they knew they were kind of pushing it because, say you've hiked, and they had to wait all this time at the base camp for months until this weather cleared, and then they're hiking all up there, and now they're like, say, 3 hours away from the summit, but that's kind of risky to go. Because you're going to get to the summit, but now you've got to get down, and they know that they're really pushing that limit of when they're supposed to turn around. But they're so jazzed because they've been practicing all their lives for this moment, and they've been waiting all season. And so a lot of them just said, screw it, I'm going to the top. I don't care if it's risky. I got to get to the top. So they get to the top, and now they got to get down. And that's when everything fell apart, and people were falling and dying, and all these things were happening. And a lot of them get back to this one camp, and now they've got to decide if anybody's going to go back out and try to find these people who fell or are missing. Now nobody's quite as eager. I thought that was really interesting because I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying it's just such this is watching something with my Dharma glasses. It was so easy to push when it was 3 more minutes and I'm at the top and I'm going to get my picture and everybody will know, and you know, they're taking pictures with their cell phones, and it was just so exciting. But it's not quite that exciting when it was like, now I got to go back out there and see if I can find anybody. And people were saying, I'm not going to do that because I'm going to risk my life. Yeah. That's exactly what you were doing when you went to the top too, is risking your life. So they sent the Sherpas. It's a very interesting story. I may not have all the details right, but the main thing that I took away with is, you know, in that case, it was a lot harder for them to do it for somebody else when their life was on the line. It was so much easier when it was kind of the glory. So if we can turn that around in our minds, you know, of what's glorious, you know. Any other thoughts or questions percolating since last week? What was the homework besides the two articles? Practice. Okay, so the field, I need y'all's field notes. You're supposed to be like practicing in long lines, going to places and offering things, finding like the most challenging situation, putting yourself in it, right? We might have some practice this week with the snow. Yeah, tell me a story.
I was on my way here last Wednesday, I think, and somehow the man in front of me thought I was too close and started gesturing. So I backed off. And then I was just driving normally. And he, again, thought I was too close. So I backed off. Then he slammed on his brakes. And I stopped. I had plenty of room because I wasn't too close. And he did that another time. And he was gesturing and turning around and screaming. And after that was all over, I realized my heart was beating the same rate. I wasn't upset. I was kind of looking at him like, wow, you really are upset. So sorry.
Yeah.
And I kept singing with the radio. That probably didn't help. But I'm singing, you know, I'm looking at him like, okay, I'll back up.
Yeah. Well, it helped you. It helped your mind stay calm, right?
I was amazed it happened automatically almost.
Good. That's great. That's wonderful.
Once.
Was there anything that helped you in particular stay calm besides singing with the radio?
I think in the past I had gotten angry at people in the car who had done things similar to that.
Right.
And afterward I realized I had a headache, I was tense.
Yeah.
And I thought, don't do that.
Right.
And
it made you feel worse.
Right.
And tense. Yeah.
It didn't accomplish anything, and this was sort of an offshoot of that.
Yeah, I know there's this one kind of analogy that's used a lot, which is that, you know, if think of somebody you love a lot, you know, usually they say your mother, but somebody who you have, you know, infinite love and compassion for, and if she suddenly went nuts and got a gun and started waving it around, you would really want to get that gun out of her hand. But you probably wouldn't go to a place in your mind that you would if that was a complete stranger. You would want to disarm her for her own sake. you would be so worried about what happened to send her over the edge like that, right? And so it's that kind of like you have to do something. You've got to get the gun out of this person's hand, but with that kind of love in your heart for them that we're trying to generate in all these kinds of situations that, you know, I just read about this guy ramming this guy's car in the Whole Foods parking lot, and the police had to come, and I mean, it's on the news, and it was, he didn't even know the guy. The guy was following him down some road like this and hitting his car over and over again, and he pulled into Whole Foods, and the guy was chasing him around, and yeah, yeah. So, I mean, this was even before they got to the Whole Foods parking lot, but so we have to find ways, you know, whatever works, you know, for us, whether it's thinking that person driving in front of me could be my mom, or, you know, for me, it just helps to look at their face. So it's not just a car. You know, if I can see somebody's face, you know, or think about what their face might be like, this is another person, not just this big car that, how many of you had a chance to read Practicing the Good Heart, which was the fifth article you did? Anybody else? Okay. I really recommend it because it's some of the things we've been talking about, or and hopefully we'll be talking about. What did you think about it?
I liked it a lot.
Okay. Anything in particular stand out to you? Yeah, give him the mic.
No, I don't have anything. Okay.
There was something in particular I wanted to point. Oh, okay. On page 34, the article starts on page 29, so it's, you know, like 10, 12 pages long. And page 33, they start talking about cherishing others. And really, this is, you know, kind of gets to the nuts and bolts of how do you do this. To practice the good heart in our everyday life is more important than anything else. Try to feel this responsibility. Think repeatedly, I am responsible for the happiness of all beings. So not just like, oh, I need to keep my mouth shut and be patient, but I'm responsible for their happiness. When we wake up in the morning, we open our eyes, we should think I'm responsible for all beings. I really try to do this on the weekends, too. I try to just lay there, okay, now wait a minute. Sometimes it doesn't work, but just saying it is like, I feel like it's going to really help me generate that habit. I think I'm really lucky to be alive today. I'm lucky that, you know, I have this kind of a life. I'm going to try today to expand my patience somehow. I'm going to try not to make anything worse. I'm going to try to be happy. And then go out and see what I can do. So like today, sometimes it's so easy, obvious examples, right? And then when somebody says, oh, you're so nice and patient. No, this was easy. It's when I'm not feeling so good that it's expanding my patience. But I was at the Whole Foods line, you know, a lot of people were there getting everything for the snow, and this woman was behind me with a cart full of food and a baby who was not happy. And I said, come on ahead of me. I mean, you'd think I'd given her gold. She was like, oh my God, thank you. I said, it's like, it's not that big of a deal. And I mean, she had a lot more food than me. And she was, are you sure my whole cart? And I was like, yeah, I don't have a baby in my hands who's about to lose it, you know. And the baby even stopped crying when I did that. I mean, this was like a one-year-old and was looking at me. And so.
Mother say, oh, my God.
I know. But her mother would just kept thanking me and thanking me. And I was like, this is such an easy thing to do, you know. But it's even easier if I think all day long that I'm responsible for the people's happiness around me. Yeah.
I got an interesting story. Last night I was at the hockey rink. My wife was playing and I was sitting. And this woman that she plays with sometimes came up to me and said, you're Buddhist, right? And I went, yeah. And she goes, well, I got a question about karma and my dog. Now, could we, like, both die and then come back, you know? And so I kind of went into a little bit of karma that they do have a good karma connection, but they might not come back exactly as a dog and a person.
Right.
But I knew that I couldn't get into the whole karma thing with
her
right then. But I told her about Buddhism in a nutshell, which started last Tuesday. And you'd think I'd given her gold, just like you said. She went, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I need to get. Because she's been thinking this way her whole life, she said.
Oh, wow.
And anyway.
That's great.
When you said giving people Dharma, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Especially somebody asking, you know, and bringing it up. That's amazing. So on page 34, he talks about, you know, how to bring this into when you're eating and drinking, when you're working, when you're caring for other people, how to make this part of every minute. So it's not just like, okay, I've got to find 10 minutes later tonight to do this meditation. It's you know, meditation, if you remember, means making yourself familiar with something. We have so many habits. And so this is trying to create some new habits. And we're in the physical world. We can conjoin that with the things that we're doing, which is why even when you're sick, they're saying you can conjoin that thought, that kind of thinking, with whatever you've got going on. Good things, bad things, neutral things, work things, sleeping things, all kinds of things. Okay? But anyway, try to at least read that article and come in next week so we can talk about that. There's so many things in here. Like, think of, you know, circle like a couple of paragraphs that you would like to talk about so that I can talk less. That's my goal, that I talk less, yeah. Okay, yeah, let's hear another story.
I'm aspirationally prompt, and I'm really happy to have that aspirational and active thought, because I'd want to be on time, and I'm rarely on time. So I'm usually in a rush, and that's part of how I get, I guess, my thrill in my life is that, oh, I just made it or something. So in the last couple of weeks, I've really been focusing on slowing down, not only slowing for myself, but not rushing other people.
Mm.
Like if I'm in a line, I'll say, I'm not in a hurry. Take your time getting me the food. And they are so happy.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend come to get me to go to a potluck, and she called, I'm going to be late. It's just a huge panic. I said, that's great. I have time to put on my lipstick. So I put on my lipstick. We went out. She didn't know where it was, but I had time to look up in my phone where we were going. And we didn't get, I think, in an accident because I could just say, no worries. We have the food. It'll be great. Instead of feeding her tension.
Right.
And seeing how that went made me think about how I do that to myself all the time.
Right.
So it's been a very powerful thing for me in the last couple of weeks.
I'd really encourage people, too, to, like, keep notes somewhere of these things, because what will happen is it'll be 6 months from now and we'll think, gosh, I never make any progress with my practice. Mm-hmm. And then you forget about these things. You forget about the small ways that you've made other people happy, that you've stretched your patience, that things did work, and they're just gone. You know, so I think it's important to just keep little notes sometimes, you know, about, and so that you can rejoice in those things. One of the things I liked, I think it's on page 39, is where he says, give your problems to your selfish mind. So it's kind of like a tonglen. We talked before about, you know, breathing in that black smoke to dissolve your problems. I mean, to dissolve all the blocks you've got. Think also of your problems. You can make it a visualization or whatever, but you think of your selfish mind, and then you throw the problems at that to destroy your selfish mind. Virtuous thoughts and everything that we're talking about depend on causes and conditions. So, I mean, I know Rabina went over that a lot, but we're the ones who set that up. It's not like, you know, someone's going to knock on the door and give them to us. We are creating the causes for that. And, you know, really, really kind of think about what's a cause for a virtuous mind. You know, where does that come from? What is the cause of cherishing others? You know, and a lot of it's going over those lists in your own mind of what is the benefits of this? What are the downsides of this? So then when you see that moment start to arise where you're either losing your patience or whatever issue you're working on, you can just go over that list. I mean, the first thing I'll think of is, yeah, this already happened. That happened. Or I don't want this to happen. But this event already happened, so losing my patience is going to get me nowhere. Anyway, any other thoughts, stories, comments, questions? All right, well, let's take a minute. We're going to end with a small Tonglen meditation, short Tonglen meditation. And So last week we talked also about, I think you asked about the, it's hard to see like the smoke coming off of a loved one. So I was thinking about that a lot this week, and I really liked that whole idea I think you had of like, you know, it's something between you all, and you're removing it. However you see it, it's something you're removing, you know, and then you're taking away that person's pain, suffering, problems, and then you're using it to destroy your selfish mind, your self-cherishing, your ignorance, your anger, whatever. So you can think either about a specific... Well, let's start with ourselves. So for me, sometimes it's hard to imagine myself in front of myself, so I just imagine my problem in front of myself, my issue, my selfishness, and see that black smoke coming towards me. And we're going to start with seeing whatever problem we want of ourselves dissolved, and then I'll cue you in when you're going to think about someone else. You can think about someone you know or somebody you don't know, a whole country, whatever, animals, whatever you want to do, Tong Lin, but let's start with ourselves. So check your posture. If you're sitting on the chair, make sure your feet are on the floor. Back is straight. You could place your left hand on the bottom, right hand on top if you'd like. Thumbs just gently touching right below your navel, making this little O. Elbows away from your sides. Chin tucked. Teeth a little bit apart. Put your tongue at the back of your upper teeth. Gently close your eyes or keep them open just a little bit to let light in and keep you alert. Take in a deep breath. Relax. And then see whatever issue in front of you, physical, mental, in the form of smoke, thick, dark smoke. And when inhale, breathe that smoke in, and you can feel it just burst through all of the blocks you have inside of yourself, your selfish mind, your ignorance, your defilements. See that smoke bursting through those obstacles, so that instead what is inside of you is this pure, clean, crystal energy of bodhicitta. And you exhale that and send that to yourself. Surround yourself with it. And do several breaths like this. And now imagine someone or some people in front of you, and imagine their suffering, their problem, in the form of thick smoke, a cloud of smoke, that you inhale, and again, this bursts through the blockages, your self-cherishing mind, and open up and freeze your pure, clean love, cherishing others, and that exhale then as pure crystal white light surrounding this other being. And just keep doing that exchange for several breaths. And then take a minute to dedicate this amazing energy that you have created by coming tonight to this class, by sharing with others, by making the effort to get here, by all the work that you do with your mind, all the positive ways that you work on expanding your good heart, that you have just created a lot of seeds that will ripen. So now dedicate how they will ripen. That you can complete the entire path. You can develop bodhicitta, see emptiness directly, know exactly how to help others, and that this will lead to your complete enlightenment. Thank you very much. Before you all leave, I'm not going to give you the speech, but I have a different speech. I think, have you ever heard of Inside Happiness Program? Because the Inside Happiness Program, I can tell you how it started because I was there. My mother came to live with me after Katrina. She was having a lot of health problems, and her speech therapist asked her if she was depressed. Understandably, she was 80, and she just lost her whole town and family and friends, and her health was declining, and she said, "I wake up every day and decide to be happy." That shook me to my little core. I was like, wow, this is amazing. So she became my muse, and I decided to start collecting other stories similar to hers. We had this event where we had Geshe-la and this other minister talk about perception and what is happiness, and we had a magician come and work with illusion, and it was wonderful. And so we had this photographer make all these photographs of these people, and we wrote their stories. That was the first Inside Happiness event years ago, and now the next generation of Kadampa Center members have taken up that gauntlet, which I'm so happy they have, and continued. And so there's going to be another Inside Happiness event. I'm forgetting the date, but all the information is out here. What is it? Yeah, I should have this memorized. March 13th. And it's going to be great. You can sell tickets to your friends. You can buy tickets. It's a fundraising event for the center. If this really takes off, what we're hoping is this will become a regular fundraising event for the center. It's not necessarily a Buddhist event. It's really about looking at what is happiness, what causes happiness, how can we create our own happiness. It's meant for the larger public. So it's exploring happiness from all different perspectives, the arts, the sciences, all kinds of things. And if you have somebody that you think would be a good speaker, then there's a committee that you can talk with and get involved with. And thank you. All right. See y'all next. I think we have two more classes in this module. Anybody know? I should know this. Really? I'm going to quote you.
it's at least next week.
Yeah, but
there's nothing behind nothing. Yeah, like April.
Well, but I have to make sure we have at least two more, right? Because
you have 2 weeks you can do it in, yeah.
Well, I don't want to do more than I have to. That's a nice attitude. This is...
Next week was the last one.
Yeah. Really? Guys, I'm supposed to give you all a test. Yeah, I'm looking for an easier way. Okay, well, we'll talk about it next week. It may be an easy test. It mostly will cover, you know, 6 perfections, the 2 types of bodhicitta. But I also want to bring in a couple things that I really, and if you are looking at me like, what test? Well, you only have to take it if you're getting certification, but I always encourage people to, because you'll always have this piece of paper with some of the answers on it that you can pull out like I did last week and say, look what I took a test on umpteen years ago, and it's really handy little notes. But also what I'm going to encourage next week is I'll have a couple of quotes that I would encourage you to pick one or two of them and memorize them, because then you'll always have that with you that you can apply in the Whole Foods parking lot or anywhere else. It'll come in really handy. Okay. Bye-bye.